Hello and welcome to Talking History. This is Brian Lebeau, the chairman of the Department of History at Creighton University, and I will be your host. As we do every week, we will begin our program with a look at This Week in History, the week of November 24th through the 30th. And our backward glance reveals that on November 24th, 1964, residents of the District of Columbia were granted permission to vote in federal elections. On November 26, 1922, Lord Carnarvon and Howard Carter unveiled the tomb of the Egyptian pharaoh Tutankhamun, popularly known as King Tut. On November 28, 1942, the United States began to ration coffee in support of the war effort in Europe. Throughout the war, U.S. citizens were also asked to forego such luxuries as chocolate and nylon so goods could be redirected to soldiers on the war front. On the 29th of November, 1877, Thomas Edison displayed his latest invention, the hand-cranked phonograph, and on November 30, 1782, Britain officially recognized the independence of the United States. And we have three items on which to report as part of this week's History in the News. First, researchers have verified the discovery earlier this year of the oldest known human-built complex of structures in North America. These earthen mounds were built about 5,400 years ago near what is now Watson's Break, Louisiana. The report issued by the journal Science notes that this settlement was built by a group of people who found food in nearby rivers and forests and occupied the site for hundreds of years. It had long been believed that hunters and gatherers such as these lacked the organizational skills to build such structures. But they did it. There are, after all, 11 mounds in a circle 280 yards across, containing hundreds of tons of dirt and gravel. One of the mounds is over 20 feet high, while the rest range from 3 to 14 feet. Still not known, however, how they did it. Second, the body of the Sioux chief Long Wolf has been returned to the United States to be buried in his tribal cemetery on Pine Ridge Reservation near Wounded Knee, near the Black Hills of South Dakota. Long Wolf died and was buried in London in 1892 after he died of pneumonia while traveling with Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show, and he was soon forgotten. A British woman, however, Elizabeth Knight, came across a book in a local antique market that contained a lament on Long Wolf's tragic life and burial. Intrigued by the story, she tracked down the grave, contacted his relatives, and they arranged for the return of his body. Long Wolf, according to family legend, was among the warriors who wiped out George Armstrong Custer's 7th Cavalry at the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876. When his tribe was eventually defeated, rather than join his fellow Sioux in subjugation, Long Wolf joined Buffalo Bill's troop. And finally, appropriately for this Thanksgiving week show, we can report that the Mayflower romance lives on. As we all learned as children, Miles Standish, a captain who could brave cannon fire but not the eyes of a woman, sent his trusted lieutenant John Alden with his marriage proposal to Priscilla Mullins, who answered, "Why don't you speak for yourself, John?" And of course, he did. It's just a romantic legend, of course, based on real people who landed aboard the Mayflower at Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1620, but much as in the poem created by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in 1858 called The Courtship of Miles Standish, the story of the principal characters had a happy ending. John and Priscilla were married. Now the historical twist. According to legend, when Priscilla accepted John's hand, Miles Standish withdrew in a very gentlemanly manner, but he now seems to have had his day. Last month, 377 years later, descendants of Priscilla and John Alden, and of Miles Standish this time, were married. Caroline Hannaford Pillsbury, a Standish descendant, and Andrew Oliver II, who traces his lineage to Priscilla and John Alden, were married at Episcopal Church of the Ascension in St. Agnes in Washington, D.C. Oliver assured reporters at the wedding that the historical literary connection was not the decisive factor in their getting together, and that he used no intermediary in proposing to Ms. Pillsbury. Meanwhile, apropos our news report on the descendants of the Aldens and Miles Standish, our major segment this week of Thanksgiving, involves a discussion of the Pilgrims and the First Thanksgiving. With us today to help us better understand both is Carolyn Freeman Travers of the Research Department at Plymouth Plantation, a recreation of the original Plymouth settlement in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Welcome, Ms. Travers, and thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Good. Maybe we should begin, give you an opportunity here to tell us a little bit about Plymouth Plantation. I understand it's their 50th anniversary.
Yes, we had our staff 50th anniversary party last night, as a matter of fact.
Great.
It was a lot of fun.
I'll bet it was. And what do we have at Plymouth Plantation for visitors?
Well, now we have, a number of sites now. We have our 1627 Pilgrim Village, which is the village, of course, set in the year 1627. The Carriage House Craft Center, where craftsmen that we have working here make pottery, turn furniture, make shoes, and do other crafts that were done in England in this period, many of which can be used in the village and aboard Mayflower 2, which is our reproduction ship, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary. And then we have Hobomok's home site, which is a recreation of an Indian home, a Wampanoag man, who lived very close to the historical Pilgrim Village.
Oh, what's the connection with the Wampanoag Indian?
Well, they were the natives who lived here in southeastern Massachusetts prior to the English coming.
And this particular individual for whom the village is named, I mean, did he have a direct connection with the residents of Plymouth?
Yes, well, historically he did have property very close to the village. It's in a land division in 1623. Two of the people are mentioned as being near Hobomok's land.
Interesting.
And he apparently acted as Massasoit, who was one of the local sachems, or leaders, as kind of his emissary, probably keeping an eye on things here.
And did we get the name Massachusetts from Massasoit?
No, the Massachusetts natives are a different group, further north, up around Boston nowadays.
Okay, so it just sounded the same.
Yes.
You mentioned this reproduction of the Mayflower. When did when was that? I guess it asks two questions here. What happened to the original Mayflower, and when was the second Mayflower put into commission here?
Well, the first Mayflower was declared in ruinis, which is Latin for kind of falling apart, in 1624, and was valued at the request of three of her four owners. And at that point was probably sold for scrap. Our Mayflower was built in Devon, in England, between 1655 and 1657, and sailed over in 57.
Based on, I would assume, a considerable amount of research in order to reproduce it as accurately as possible?
That's correct.
Right. And the original Mayflower didn't last very much longer after it brought the Pilgrims to Massachusetts then?
No, it was probably... not an old ship, but probably several decades old at that point, since they did have a very important beam under the main and under the mainmast cracked during the voyage.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Which nearly sent everybody to the bottom of the sea.
Okay. Well, let's get to it. Tell us a little bit about the Pilgrims. Maybe we should start there. Who were these people that came to Massachusetts?
Well, it kind of depends on who you ask. Because some people use the term pilgrim to mean just the separatists who are members of a Reformed church who came over first from England to Holland and then from Holland to here, escaping, persecution in England and then bad economic conditions and coming war in Holland. And some people use it to mean all of the Mayflower passengers, and only about half of them were separatists.
I see. And how did they end up in Massachusetts?
Well, navigation of the period was not so exact as it is today. I mean, now we have satellites, and you can tell within a few feet exactly where you are on the planet. With things like astrolabes and backstaffs and crossstaffs and dead reckoning, you kind of headed in the direction you thought you wanted to go in, and you might be a little far off north or south. And then when you figured out where you were, you went up or down the coast, depending.
So they're
get lost between England and France.
Okay. So they're heading for Virginia. They land in Massachusetts. Why didn't they just continue on to Virginia?
Well, they were heading for the northern parts of Virginia,
mm-hmm.
which is right about where New York City is nowadays, the Hudson River.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at a map, actually hitting Cape Cod isn't that far north.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is you have to get around the shoals to get south. or southwest, and it's extremely dangerous, and many times, well, it still is dangerous, and they decided because of the lateness of the season and the general bad weather and the difficulty of heading south that they decided that they would settle in New England and then work about getting a legal patent to stay here.
Okay. Well, legal patent, how did that connect with the rather famous Mayflower Compact?
The Mayflower Compact was an interim agreement because there were people who felt because they didn't land where they were supposed to, where they had a legal right, according to the English government, to settle, that there was no law, that anybody could, I suppose, take their stuff and go away, go wherever they wanted. And this was an agreement for them to stay together until they could get a patent.
And what was said, what was in this document that makes it so important to us?
Well, from their point of view, it was the first time they really hit a crisis point. I mean, the cracked beam in midway across the ocean, they really couldn't do anything about.
Mm-hmm.
That was up to the ship's carpenter and the sailors to fix. That wasn't their choice. Here, it was a choice to either completely fall apart, which many colonies did, or band together despite their differences,
mm-hmm.
and make a go of it, make a community of it, and they did that. They agreed to follow the laws that were set by the laws of England, plus whatever they needed to come up with themselves.
Right.
And they had no basis for this. I mean, they didn't have any legal right to do it, really.
Okay.
And they did it anyway, and it worked.
Good.
And
okay.
Here we are.
Right. Now, the next question, I'm from Massachusetts, and you're there now, and I know landing in December in Massachusetts must have been tough. So what happened during their first winter in Massachusetts?
Well, the first winter was pretty grim. They settled here in Plymouth ultimately, but it took them 3 weeks or more of exploration trying to find a site that they thought they would like. The Cape was fine, but the soil is rather sandy and fresh water is a problem, in fact, as it is today. They coasted around in the shallop, and of course people started getting sick. They say scurvy and other diseases. You can imagine a rather hard shipboard diet with a lot of preserved food, very little fresh food after the first few weeks, and half of them died that winter.
Half of them.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Okay. But at least half survived, so to speak. The old half glass, half empty, half full here. And I assume then they were able to get some crops into the ground and some buildings constructed the following spring. And what happened during that particular time period?
Actually, they started building before Christmas as the men who could came on shore and started building
mm-hmm.
a common house first and then setting up other houses for the different families. So by spring, they had 7 houses completed
uh-huh.
and 4 storehouses. So they planted crops. They had taken some Indian corn, which was stashed. They called them Indian barns. They're holes in the ground with mats over them to keep them stored and away from animals. So they borrowed it, intending to repay the owners whenever they found them,
mm-hmm.
which they did eventually do.
Mm-hmm.
But they used that as the basis for their main crop, which was the Indian corn.
Okay. Now, one would assume it had to be a fairly, at least if not prosperous, successful summer leading into this first Thanksgiving in the fall. What do we know about this first Thanksgiving?
Well, by their lights, it wasn't a Thanksgiving. A Thanksgiving is a church service, more
mm-hmm.
like an extra Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't involve feasting, doesn't involve games, doesn't involve inviting the neighbors over. What they would have had, according to their lights, was a harvest festival.
Uh-huh.
It lasted 3 days. They invited Massasoit and some 90 of his men, plus perhaps others. They entertained them. They feasted. They played games. They exercised their arms, which would be military displays. And, well, much like they would have done in England after a successful harvest.
So there would have been more Native Americans than pilgrims,
mm-hmm.
and it lasted 3 days, and this was quite a harvest festival then.
It was. I think they were very, very happy that they had spent the year as successfully as they had. They really thought they were going to make it.
How do we know this? What accounts do we have of the first Thanksgiving?
We have two. One was written by Edward Winslow in a book which is now known as Mort's Relation. The title is actually much longer. And the other is William Bradford, who was the second governor of the colony. His history, which is of Plymouth Plantation.
Hmm. Okay.
So and Edward Winslow, in fact, I can read it to you. It only takes about a paragraph.
Okay, go ahead.
Our harvest being gotten in, our governor sent 4 men on fowling, so that we might after a special manner rejoice together after we had gathered the fruit of our labors. They four in one day killed as much fowl as, with little help beside, served the company almost a week, at which time, amongst other recreations, we exercised our arms. Many of the Indians coming amongst us, and among the rest their greatest king, Massasoit, with some 90 men, whom for 3 days we entertained and feasted.
Hmm, that's it.
Pretty much. It goes on for another couple details.
Sure, sure.
But not a great deal,
okay.
And that's pretty much what we know.
All right. Well, two questions along that line then. Did it happen in late November, do you think, the first Thanksgiving?
No reason to. Well, Harvest Festival happens after harvest, logically enough. And harvest of Indian corn is late September, early October, depending on the year.
Okay. And second question, you've alluded to it earlier, but we would assume they weren't limited just to turkey and mashed potatoes.
No mashed potatoes. No, they have turkey, well, wild fowl, mm-hmm. which means geese, ducks, swans perhaps, turkeys, of course. In the other account by William Bradford, he mentions cod and bass and other fish. They had... the natives had gone out, and that's how it sent several men out, and they went out and killed five deer, which they brought back and bestowed on the governor and the captain and others, so they would have had the five deer, the venison from those, and of course the Indian corn.
Sounds like...
So that's all they talk about.
Yeah.
They might have had fruit, they probably had vegetables, but they don't say so.
That's quite a feast, actually. Sounds great. What do you think they had to drink?
Possibly beer. Or ale, more likely, because they don't talk about growing hops, and they would have made the distinction between beer, which is made with hops, and ale, which is not.
Right.
They said their barley was indifferent good, which is sort of like, well, what does that mean?
Okay.
Probably means it was okay, there was some.
Right.
So they might have brewed up beer. They might have just had water.
Okay. What did they, I'm curious about that. Did they drink much water, or were they afraid of it? Did they trust the water was pure?
Well, they did mention that the water here was almost as good as beer. And so the water, of course, in England had been polluted, and living there for thousands and thousands of years, the water was polluted. It wasn't safe to drink.
Yeah. Well,
and if you're living the kind of rather hard laboring life that they were leading at the time, it's been estimated that they needed about 3,000 calories a day.
Interesting.
Which is a great deal.
It is.
Of course,
yeah.
Water gives you nothing.
Right.
Beer is liquid bread.
Okay.
It gives you a lot of protein and a lot of calories.
Okay, well, let's hear it for the beer. All right, very good. Okay, now, you mentioned this is a harvest festival. In many respects, it sounds like from the accounts you read, this was not a particularly big deal, and yet it became an annual, eventually national celebration. How did we get from that first harvest festival to having a national holiday of Thanksgiving?
Well, our holiday is really kind of our modern Thanksgiving holiday. It's kind of a combination of three holidays. There's the harvest festival, and there's the day of Thanksgiving, which, as I said, is an extra church service. And as life became more secular across the 17th and 18th centuries, the two kind of combined. They would have a Thanksgiving to celebrate a good harvest. That was one of the common things. It would be declared by the governor or sometimes by the church.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have a church service, but followed by a dinner. So when people in the Victorian period, historians, many of them New Englanders, got very curious about, well, when was the first Thanksgiving? So they were the ones who looked back, found this description by Edward Winslow, and said, huh, there it is, food, feasting, neighbors, celebration, fall, here we are. But really, it doesn't come into national prominence until the Civil War.
And that we ordinarily attribute to Lincoln in 1863. Why did Lincoln focus on a day of Thanksgiving?
Because Sarah Josepha Hale nagged him into it, I think. She was an editor of Godey's Ladies' Book, which was a very influential women's magazine of the period.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a New Englander, and she thought America ought to celebrate Thanksgiving the way New Englanders did, and she campaigned very hard for it to become a national festival, which Lincoln eventually did.
And what date did he pick?
He picked the last Thursday in November in 1863, and that became kind of the standard, the idea being that it would be far enough away from the regional Thanksgivings, with other people's harvests, of course, you have your harvest whenever your harvest is done, or whenever your crops are done and ready to harvest. So the idea of late November would be to get it away from the regions and into a national holiday. And, of course, New England didn't really celebrate Christmas at this time.
Right.
So it became the big well, fall, early winter celebration in place of Christmas.
And how do we get back to what, you know, the fourth Thursday that we use now?
Oh, that was thanks to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Because they, well, then, as well, in the 1939, the merchants got together and pressured him to declare it. Because, it was still a declared holiday. It wasn't a legal holiday in the same way it is now. They wanted it moved back because it was going to be the fifth Thursday in November at that point, and they didn't like the short shopping season for Christmas. So they pushed him into declaring it a week early. He did, not realizing what havoc it would cause. And you know who was really upset?
Who? Tell
me. Football coaches.
Football, why?
Because the big game is always Thanksgiving Day.
Oh.
And suddenly it was just Thursday.
Interesting. Okay.
So people, he had changed tradition. Mm-hmm. It wasn't right.
Mm-hmm.
They got really upset. Some people held it on the fourth Thursday. Some people held it on the fifth. It became Franksgiving, if you followed what he wanted you to do. And say if you lived in Connecticut and worked in New York, your family had one Thanksgiving and you had the other.
So football and Christmas shopping influenced Thanksgiving even in the 1930s.
It did. So the compromise ultimately was the fourth Thursday, most years will be the last Thursday of the month, but not always.
Very interesting. And very briefly, do we have a Thanksgiving dinner at Plymouth Plantation today?
Kind of. Our food service, Creative Gourmet, has one for the public. But of course, since we represent 1627, not 1621, there's no reason to. There's no historic festival on that time.
Well, I bet it's a nice occasion anyway.
It's very busy,
but it's
a lot of fun.
Okay. Well, that's probably a good note on for which to end. We're about out of time. Thank you, Ms. Travers, for being with us today, and I'll hope you will join us again soon.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Once again, Carolyn Freeman Travers is in the research department at Plymouth Plantation. For further information on Plymouth, write to Plymouth Plantation, Post Office Box 1620, Plymouth, Massachusetts, 02360, or call 508-746-1622. Well, we have a special concluding piece to offer you this week as part of our celebration of Thanksgiving. It's a personal history of Thanksgiving offered by Brent Spencer, Director of Creative Writing at Creighton University. Spencer's fiction has appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, the American Literary Review, the Missouri Review, GQ, and elsewhere. He's also the author of the novel The Lost Son and of a short story collection called Are We Not Men, which was chosen as one of the best books of 1996 by the editors of The Village Voice. Here, then, is Brent Spencer's personal history of Thanksgiving.
In my house, the history of Thanksgiving is the history of meat. A lot of meat. Tiny tin-sized turkeys glistening in their juices. Blushing hams studded with cloves. Venison, duck, Cornish hens, and always, always kielbasa. A world of meat. At the first touch of my knife, everything fell away in steamy chunks and neatly layered slices. I was expert in the geometry of meat. And I knew the purpose of Thanksgiving. To eat like there was no tomorrow. To eat until your arteries closed up shop, until your heart stopped, until all you could do was crawl into the living room and die on the rug in front of televised football. And then, of course, there was the food hangover on the following day. That was Thanksgiving. That was living. Oh, sure, I knew about the Pilgrims, the creative team responsible for Thanksgiving, but all I knew for sure about them was that on the scale of human evolution, they fell somewhere between Australopithecus and Bill Gates. But beyond that and their crimes against fashion, I was pretty much in the dark. I knew there were Indians somewhere in the mix, that there was something to do with burying an ear of corn, But I always took that to be the Indians' way of saying, we hate vegetables, give us meat. After all, you didn't see them burying a meatloaf. But a few months ago, two things happened. I discovered a Native American in my family history, and I gave up eating meat. This will be my first meatless Thanksgiving. Or should I say, my first yam-centered Thanksgiving. It's the first real crisis of my vegetarian life. You could say I'm doing this year's Thanksgiving cold turkey, so to speak. What will I do without my usual near-death dining experience, my turkey tango? I'll think about my Cherokee ancestor, a tamer of wild horses well into his 70s, what a recent popular novel calls a horse whisperer. I'll think about my personal history and the history of my people. I'll think about my happy arteries and the joyful pumping of my surprised heart. And maybe, just maybe, I'll even give thanks.
Once again, you've been listening to Brent Spencer's Personal History of Thanksgiving. Spencer is the author of the novel The Lost Son and the short story collection Are We Not Men? And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have any comments to offer, questions to raise, topics to suggest for future programs, send them to us either here by email at talkinghistory, all one word, at creighton.edu, or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau. Have a nice Thanksgiving.